This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 14th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, Obama heads to the Gulf Coast as BP responds to increased pressure over the oil spill. Renewed violence in Kyrgyzstan sends thousands fleeing to the southern border.
This is about to chase out the Uzbeks of us.
And we'll go to South Africa, where poor residents are demanding adequate housing in the shadow of the World Cup soccer tournament.
We find it very strange with the World Cup. See the stadiums that they've built. How many billions have been spent there? We are living in a disaster area.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Neil Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court today said that a Canadian man cannot sue high-level U.S. officials, including former Attorney General John Ashcroft, over his rendition to Syria, where he was subsequently tortured. Maher Arar was picked up in New York in 2002, identified as a possible member of al-Qaeda. He was in U.S. custody for nearly 2 weeks with little access to counsel and was then sent to Syria. A Canadian investigation found that Arar was tortured there. Canada has already paid him $10 million for providing inaccurate information about him to U.S. authorities. Arar sought relief under the Torture Victims Protection Act. The High Court denied his appeal without explanation. Justices also announced today that during their next term, they will consider California's challenge to a court order to reduce its prison population by 40,000, such that it can provide adequate physical and mental health care to inmates. Kenya's president, Mwai Kibaki, is calling for an investigation into explosions at a political rally in Nairobi yesterday that killed at least 6 people. More than 100 were injured in an ensuing stampede. Abdul Karim Jamali reports from Nairobi.
The twin blast in the Kenyan capital last night hit a campaign rally organized by judge leaders and politicians, including ministers opposed to a draft constitution. Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga spoke Sunday evening at Kenyatta National Hospital.
This is a very unfortunate incident where so many people have been injured, have been given a full brief by the doctor in charge, that 3 lives have been lost. It is a very, very regrettable incident, and this kind of incident stands condemned in the strongest terms possible by the government.
The death toll later rose to 6 and the wounded to more than 100 people, according to the medical sources. After both the election violence in 2007 killed more than 1,000 people, a deal to share power was reached that includes rewriting the nation's constitution. Kenyans will vote in early August on the proposed changes. Abdul Karim Jimale, FSRN, Nairobi.
A team of U.S. geologists and a Pentagon task force says vast deposits of valuable minerals beneath war-torn Afghanistan could be worth as much as $1 trillion. The trove includes lithium, copper, iron, and gold. But knowledge of the underground natural resource wealth is not new. Soviet experts compiled mineral charts and maps in the 1980s. The USGS and the Navy issued a report on the matter in 2007. In the West Bank, an Israeli soldier is dead and 2 other officers injured in a drive-by shooting today. 2 groups have claimed responsibility. Both are connected to the Palestinian Authority's Fatah movement. The region had been largely peaceful for some time, and Israel had eased checkpoints in the West Bank, a move some critics say is responsible for today's attack. The last of 4 Colombian soldiers freed yesterday from FARC captivity was found today. He hid during yesterday's rescue raid in the nation's southern jungle. The 4 were kidnapped by the FARC guerrillas in 1998 during a siege on the capital of an eastern Colombian province. The men will arrive in Bogota and reunite with their families today. In Philadelphia, the Boy Scouts are taking the city to court over what they say is a matter of free speech and equal protection. The city says the Scouts' refusal to admit gay youth violates local charter. Matthew Petrillo was in the courtroom today.
A Supreme Court decision from 2000 permits the Boy Scouts to exclude openly gay members because the Boy Scouts are considered a membership organization. But today's week-long jury trial will decide whether the Cradle Liberty Council, which is the Philly chapter of the Boy Scouts of America, will be evicted from its Philadelphia headquarters because it sits on city-owned land. The Boy Scouts have been paying a nominal fee to rent the land for decades, but the city's mayor argues he will not subsidize discrimination. Representatives for the local Scout Council contend the city is breaching their liberty, specifically their First and 14th Amendment rights.
They all have a First Amendment right. The government cannot come in and try to strong-arm them and try to twist their arm and force them by trying to change their membership policies.
Bill McSwain represents the council and says the city shouldn't target the Scouts Philadelphia chapter, citing standards set by its national parent. He argues the city singles out the Boy Scouts, saying it disregards other city-funded groups that discriminate, such as the women-only organization, the Colonial Dames. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
Searchers found the body today of the last person thought to be missing after flash floods killed 20 people in Arkansas on Friday. Crews continue to search through the woods around the Albert Pike Recreation Area. Floodwaters rose as much as 8 feet per hour last week after heavy rains caused the Little Missouri River to overflow. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. President Obama is in the Gulf of Mexico assessing the damage of the oil spill. It's his fourth tour of the region since the British Petroleum deepwater rig explosion. Meanwhile, the federal government is pushing BP to establish a special account to pay for cleanup and recovery. Yin Mei Xie reports from Washington on how this new compensation mechanism will affect victims of the ongoing disaster.
The special account that President Obama wants BP to set up works much like a trust fund. BP will put in a certain amount of money into the account. A third-party panel manages the fund. Victims of the oil spill apply to the panel for compensation, and those whose claims get approved will receive money. The president's senior advisor, David Axelrod, told NBC that such an arrangement will prevent BP from dragging its feet on payments.
So that they won't be slow-walked on these claims. There are people there who live from week to week and whose livelihoods have been taken away from them here. And we want to make sure that they can get through this.
In legal terminology, such an account is called an escrow account. The idea is endorsed by many lawmakers. 54 Democratic senators want BP to put $20 billion up front into such an account. Some Republicans also support the move, especially those in Gulf Coast states. Alabama Governor Bob Riley says having an independent administrator managing the claim process is a big help.
There are so many people in the state of Alabama today that just literally have not gone out and filed legitimate claims to be compensated by BP because they think that ultimately BP is the arbiter, and so many people tell me, well, it's just a waste of time.
Riley spoke to CBS over the weekend. With an escrow account, BP will no longer be the decision maker, and the victims could get money faster. David Hunter is an environmental law professor at American University.
Claimants would be able to go and say, I was a fisherman. I can no longer fish in these waters because the oil spilled. And so that can become a fairly quick administrative process, and you don't have to have a huge trial over negligence or some of the causation issues.
Fishermen, at least, stand a good chance to get compensated through lawsuits, says Hunter.
But people to whom they sell their fish, who have not seen any direct impact from the oil, let's say restaurateurs or people who market fish, they're going to have a difficult time through the tort system. Their claims probably wouldn't be allowed, frankly.
So an escrow account could also help those who suffer losses indirectly from the oil spill. In addition, Hunter says, it would make sure that money is available even if BP goes bankrupt. Over the weekend, President Obama spoke by phone with the British Prime Minister David Cameron. Obama reportedly assured Cameron that he had no interest in undermining the value of BP. but he also stressed that the company will have to pay for cleanup and people's economic losses. Financial experts and federal officials say it's unlikely that BP will go bankrupt. Here's Admiral Thad Allen of the Coast Guard, who's the government's point man in the Gulf, speaking on CBS.
Well, I think our assumption is BP is a going concern. They're a company that's got a lot of wealth inside it. Now, that, I don't think that's a consideration.
Allen says the federal government has pressed BP to move faster and more aggressively to contain the oil spill. And Monday, BP outlined a path to contain more than 50,000 barrels of oil per day by the end of June. That's 2 weeks earlier than they originally suggested. BP executives will meet with President Obama in the White House this Wednesday, and they're likely to discuss whether and how to set up an escrow account. Yan Meixie, FSRN, Washington.
Also today, Chevron said an oil leak in Utah that sent 33,000 gallons into creeks leading to the Salt Lake was caused by an electrical arc that made a hole in the pipe. The company said it was first notified of it Saturday morning, though media reports say residents could smell petroleum on Friday. The spill has coated some 300 birds, and the oil threatens endangered fish in the area. Violence in southern Kyrgyzstan has sent thousands of refugees to the border. According to the AP, an official said at least 100,000 Uzbeks left cities and towns and were waiting for entry into Uzbekistan. The 4 days of violence has killed some 117 and demolished entire blocks of the southern city of Osh. The interim government gave its security forces orders to shoot to kill as mobs roam the streets. The current leadership came to power after a bloody coup in April, and the country faces a constitutional referendum at the end of this month. Heinrich Keith Hansen is with the International Media Support, an organization based in Copenhagen that supports local media in countries affected by conflict and in political transition. He was in the city of Osh during the latest violence. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
You were in Osh when the latest violence broke out. What did you see in those first few hours?
Well, actually, in the first hours after the conflict broke out, I didn't see much. I was at a hotel, but I was called by some of the contacts I had in the city, and they told me that a very big fight had broken out and that a lot of people got killed in that fight. And then during the night, I heard a lot of gunshots around in the city, and I noticed, you know, houses that were set on fire. I saw the smoke from these fires. The next morning, I went out of the hotel early in the morning to see what was going on, and I saw a almost deserted city with very few people in it, mostly young men running around the streets with homemade weapons, blocking the roads and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And what was the police presence like when you went out on the streets?
There were none. I didn't see any police. I didn't see any military.
Now, there's been violence on both sides of this, but many of the reports are that the Uzbek businesses have been targeted. Many of the victims of attacks have been Uzbeks. The government has downplayed the ethnic dimension of the violence. What did you hear from people in Osh about how they see this violence?
The people in Osh, the people I talked to, and also, which is important to add, I was at a hotel with two OSCE observers who had been there for 2 weeks to observe the country before the referendum on the 27th of June, and they also told me that this is clearly ethnical. They called it ethnical cleansing, that this is about to chase out the Uzbeks of Osh.
Now, when you spoke to people there in Osh, was there a sense of people really wanting to leave, to get out, or that people wanted to stay and waited for authorities to come and secure the place? Or what was the feeling that people had?
The feeling I had, and the feeling, you know, I know a lot of other people had, was that the Uzbeks, you know, they had to leave pretty fast. I've also heard that, because I've been Skyping and emailing back and forth with several Kyrgyz contacts today, and they told me that they know that several Kyrgyz families living in and around Osh are actually hiding Uzbeks, you know, in their basement or wherever it's possible to hide someone in their houses, because they want to protect them against those gangs who are simply killing them.
Well, you finally managed to get out of the city, but had a scary confrontation on the bus on the way to the helicopters. What happened?
Yeah, it was quite scary, quite dramatic. We were stopped by a very, very large group of young people with their homemade weapons. They managed to stop us. And those young men, they wanted the weapons of the soldiers. The soldiers didn't want to give them their weapons. And then all of a sudden, a lot of these young guys, they climbed the military vehicle and started fighting with the soldiers to get their weapons. One soldier fell to the ground and they got his weapon. And then the other soldiers at the military vehicle started shooting, not directly at the young guys. They, you know, shot just over their heads or up in the air. And all of us in the bus, just, you know, just right behind it, we fell to the floor of the bus to seek some kind of protection. But these young guys, they just kept on fighting to get those weapons. And then finally, the military people, they shot directly into the crowd to make them stay away. And I saw at least two young persons falling to the ground because they were hit. And in this way, they dispersed the crowd. But then the crowd turned to the bus where we were sitting and started to beat on the bus with their sticks and weapons and threw stones and rocks towards the bus. But luckily, the military vehicle in front of us, they sped up and they drove fast towards the base, and we followed it. So we finally got into the base and nobody got hurt.
That's Heinrich Keith Hansen with International Media Support. He was in southern Kyrgyzstan when the violence erupted last week and joined us by phone from Copenhagen. Public school teachers in the Mexican state of Oaxaca mobilized today as part of ongoing labor negotiations and to commemorate the anniversary of a police action that sparked a popular uprising 4 years ago today. Shannon Young has more from Oaxaca City.
The day of action kicked off at 4 a.m. local time with chants, bottle rockets, and barricades around the central plaza of Oaxaca City. While this has become an annual occurrence here, this year's protests come just 3 weeks ahead of the elections to replace the governor the 2006 movement tried to oust. During a pre-dawn rally in the central plaza, union representative Jose Alfredo Martinez stopped short of calling for a punishment vote against the ruling party, but said the teachers' union must continue to demand accountability for the political murders committed during the 2006 conflict.
We have to push for the political trial and imprisonment of the assassin of the people of Oaxaca, and we have to tell our rank-and-file membership, regardless of whoever wins the state gubernatorial race, if we teachers can't deliver on our list of demands, the absence of accountable government will continue.
The mega march called by the teachers' union today was miles long and drew at least 100,000 people. Due to its strength, the teachers' union has the support of many of the state's social and activist organizations, but the movement also has its critics. An estimated 1.4 million school children miss class whenever the teachers mobilize en masse. Another common complaint is the vehicular chaos provoked by frequent marches and blockades. Businesses in the downtown area often report losses whenever the teachers set up protest encampments in the central square. Mr. Fernando, who runs a small sandwich stall in the center of the plaza, says his sales have declined by 30% since the protest encampment began 2 weeks ago. He just wants both sides to reach an agreement so he can recover economically.
We ask the authorities and the government to resolve this quickly. This always ends in an arrangement, but it always comes after they've been here a while and they get tired, or after the government says, fine, we'll give you this much, and they pick up their things and leave. So why not do all this beforehand without dragging this all out and waiting for each side to wear down before negotiating?
But negotiations between the teachers' union and the state and federal government have stagnated. The teachers have announced they will triple the size of their protest encampment in the city center as of Tuesday morning. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
The FIFA Soccer World Cup is underway in South Africa. The first such tournament on African soil is being met with excitement and high expectations, but there are tensions as well. Over the weekend, riot police fired tear gas on workers protesting conditions at one of the stadiums in Durban. One worker told the New York Times that they were being paid far less than promised and had to walk hours home after being guaranteed transportation. Today, the World Cup organizers say police have now taken over responsibility for security at the stadiums in Cape Town, citing the wage dispute. Also at the World Cup, despite gleaming stadiums and million-dollar infrastructure, housing remains vastly inadequate for millions of people in the country. Davison Makanga brings us more on the so-called shack dwellers' response to the World Cup.
This is a dream come true for 19-year-old Atuel Ngoma. The World Cup finally kicking off in his home country, South Africa.
Hey, I am feeling very good. It's the year that I was wishing to see it. It's still alive.
Ngoma is one of the 4,000 people watching an opening match at a public viewing area in the informal settlement of Deep Sloot, north of Johannesburg, the commercial seat of South Africa. It is a chilly afternoon, and as Ngoma joins in the soccer frenzy, he knows very well what this winter cold means. He lives in a 64-square-foot corrugated shack. I ask him what he wants the government to do after the World Cup.
Maybe to build the house for people who don't have the houses, who are still in the squatter camps.
In the compound of his friend Gifty Modisa Dife, the duo described life in a shack known as Mkuku in local language isiZulu.
No, it's too hard.
Especially nothing. In winter time. In winter time, hey, these shakes are not good. Serious.
How are they? Are they cold?
Too cold.
Better housing for the poor is what Abahlali Basem Jondolo, an association for the homeless, has been fighting for. Last week, the association picketed at the provincial offices for housing in Cape Town.
How can government, since 2004, not building houses for people? So we, really, about the World Cup, there is nothing that the poor people are benefiting from.
Mtobe Likona has lived in a shack for more than 10 years in the township of Khayelitsha, Cape Town. In his community alone, which is just a small section of Khayelitsha, about 4,000 people live in shacks without electricity or running water.
We don't have toilets. You must go to the formal houses, the brick houses, and back toilets, and then you pay 50 cents a day. So they make it for about 20 rand a month. Because we don't have. How can we be happy living in this place? You can see, even you go down, it's smelling dirty. Everything is around is here. How can you be happy? We can't. We can't be happy.
And living in such conditions, Kona feels hard done by the government. He says part of the billions of dollars used to build infrastructure, such as stadiums and roads, should have been committed to housing.
The government forget that it's the people who are right now in the ground, on the ground level, who have voted for them. The government right now forget really for the people who voted for them to be where they are today.
The government has built some makeshift houses known as temporary residence areas. But the slum dwellers declined the offer, describing it as an insult.
We said to the government he must take his dogs and pigs to those TRA houses and build proper houses.
In the Orange Farm community, some 25 miles south of Johannesburg, activist Gladys Mokolo lives under the same conditions as Kona does in Cape Town. She squarely blames the government for misplaced priorities.
When we were voting, they promised us that everything will be fine, but there's nothing that it's fine. But we find it very strange with the World Cup. See the stadiums that they've built. How many billions have been spent there? We are living in a disaster area.
Mokolo says the community will continue to push the government to provide adequate housing for South Africans.
We as people, we have to stand up and raise our voices and fight until things will be fine. Because even if when black people are taking power, they were fighting. So we can't just stay because we've been fighting the apartheid and say now because this is our a country now, we can't fight. We'll be fighting until we get the right thing.
As the World Cup continues in 9 stadiums around the country, the government is emphasizing that the tournament will leave a lifelong legacy. People like Makolo hope the positive spin-off, if any, will translate to better housing. Tevson Makanga, FSRIN, Johannesburg.
Also, in other World Cup news, in Somalia, 2 people were killed after militants raided a house where a group was watching a soccer game on TV. The group, Hizbul Islam, arrested another 10 at the home. At least 15 teenagers were arrested Sunday night for watching games. The Islamist group, along with another, Al-Shabaab, have threatened fans who watch the games on TV, forcing many to view the games in secret. Entertainment, like watching sports, is considered illegal by the groups under a strict interpretation of Sharia law. Today, Israel opened an investigation into the deadly attack on a Gaza humanitarian convoy 2 weeks ago. Israel has resisted calls for an international investigation, but says the 3-person panel will be joined by 2 international observers. The panel will also decide on whether the blockade on Gaza is legal under international law. The blockade has come under intense criticism since the May 31st attack, and this weekend, for the first time since the blockade was imposed in June 2007, the Arab League chief Amir Moussa visited Gaza. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
Amir Moussa came to Gaza to meet with NGOs and representatives of Hamas, Fatah, and other political factions. The Arab League's Secretary General entered through the Rafah crossing, which Egypt recently opened to some Palestinians in the wake of the flotilla attack.
Not only the Arabs, but also the entire world are standing behind the people of Palestine against the Gaza blockade and what is happening to the entire occupied territories, including East Jerusalem.
Moussa's visit is also a part of the Arab League's drive toward reaching a long-awaited Palestinian unity agreement between Hamas and the Western-backed Fatah Party with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. After touring war-torn areas of the coastal enclave, the Arab chief spoke to reporters. He emphasized the need for Fatah and Hamas to reach an agreement so that a reconstruction process could begin. FSRN asked Moussa what role the Arab League can play in easing the blockade on Gaza.
I believe that President Obama has well said what he said, that the situation in Gaza is unsustainable. It should not continue, which means that the United States understands the perils of the continuation of the siege and works in the direction of lifting it in a certain political way or according to certain political initiative that we have to be involved in. What should be said also, what should be mentioned, is that the European Council of Ministers is going to meet tomorrow to discuss this, the case of siege, whether lifting or relaxing.
The ruling Hamas party in Gaza says Moussa's visit is a significant development that might lead to breaking the Israeli siege and reconciling Hamas and Fatah on the basis of Palestinian national interests. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Yan Meixier. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at FSRN.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at FSRN.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.